Welcome to Already Perfect, the Seattle Soto Zen podcast. And I needed a push to get me to see wherever I am, I'm already
free. So today we're going to discuss the opening paragraph of Dogen Zenji's famous essay, Genjo Koan. And, you know, the Soto Zen group I used to sit with in Canada, we had a book club. We'd read, the first year I was there, we read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind together. And the Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind is a collection of lecture transcripts by Shunryu Suzuki. And we noticed that in these lectures, Suzuki Roshi, he had a habit of using this phrase, the most important thing. Most important thing is, and then, but every time he said it, he'd end with a different most important thing. So it'd be like, most important thing in Zen practice is to keep your spine straight. And then most important thing in Zen practice is to accept yourself. Most important thing in Zen practice is to follow the precepts, you know? So when we were studying Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, we would each take turns reading aloud, and we'd do one chapter a week. And it got to the point whenever the person who was reading would say the most important thing, the rest of us would all crack up. So there's a Shosan ceremony when Suzuki Roshi was alive, which is a formal Q&A with the abbot. So One of his students tried to pin him down and use this opportunity to get the final word on this. And he said, you know, for the last time, really, what is the most important thing? And Suzuki Roshi said, the most important thing is to find out what is the most important thing. And I kind of feel like this is what Master Dogen's Genjo Koan is trying to do, to support us in finding out what is the most important thing. And, you know, kind of to try to give the readers the insight and confidence to fully inhabit my own human life. To live as, you know, an authentic human being, which on the face of it, it doesn't really sound like that much. But of course, it's unexpectedly complicated. So here is the beginning of Genjo Koan. When all dharmas are the Buddha Dharma, then there is delusion and realization. There is practice, life and death. There are Buddhas and there are ordinary people. When the myriad dharmas are each not of the self, then there is no delusion, no Buddhas, no ordinary beings, no life and death. No life and no death. And this is quite a confusing way to start. The Suzuki Roshi's version. When all things are Buddhism, there is birth and death. There are defilement, practice, birth and death, Buddhas, and sentient beings. When all things has no self, there is no delusion, no Buddha, no sentient beings, no birth, no death. And this is, you know, a confusing way to start, because when all things are Buddha Dharma, is it, you know, aren't things always Buddha Dharma? And when all things are without self, I mean, things are without self. That's, we chant the Heart Sutra every morning service. And that's what it's all about. It says that right there. So this confuses me, the temporality of it, right? So it's kind of like, well, the breakfast menu, birth and death, delusion and realization. The lunch menu, we have no birth, no death, no delusion, and no realization. And it, you know, I find that confusing. I think I'm not sure I understand, and there are a lot of different scholars have weighed in different ways about these first two lines. You know, speaking of the Zen Mind Beginner's Mind Book Club, you know, I was really reluctant to join the book club when I found out about it, because I had already read Zen Mind Beginner's Mind and I hated it. You know, when I ask people, when I tell people that, they tend to be really surprised. And they're like, well, but why? Why did you feel that way? And, you know, because when I read Zen Mind Beginner's Mind when I was 17, and I didn't really need a reason to hate things outside of being 17. And then, you know, 10 years later, I read it again and I expected to hate it again because I could remember hating it. But I really enjoyed it. I got a lot out of it. You know, it's kind of like one of Mark Twain's famous quotes is, he says, you know, when I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant, couldn't even stand to have the old guy around. But when I reached the age of 21, I was just astonished at how much the old man had learned in 7 years. It was even more astonishing for me because Suzuki Roshi had been dead the whole time. Don't expect people to improve that much when they're dead. So, when all things are Buddha Dharma, there is practice, birth and death, delusion and realization, and there are Buddhas and sentient beings. When the myriad dharmas are without self, there is no delusion, no realization, no sentient beings, no birth and no death. First two lines. The Buddha's truth is originally transcendent over abundance and scarcity. And so there is birth and death. There is delusion and realization. There are living beings and Buddhas. So you can see, so the abundance is the state in which all things exist. You know, there is an actual reality in which things exist. And then scarcity is the state in which all phenomena are empty. Or maybe scarcity is delusion, death and sentient beings, and abundance is life, Buddhas, and realization. So Suzuki Roshi says, Buddhism originally is beyond all positivity or negativity. So there are birth and death, defilement and enlightenment, and sentient beings and Buddhas. Francis Cook tries to help me out. And his book, The Sounds of Valley Streams, he said, at this point in the review of possible interpretations of these first three lines, it may be worthwhile to point out several details of this whole passage that might be overlooked by a reader. First, in each of the two lines, Dogen speaks of an occasion, jisetsu, a time when or an occasion of seeing things as existent without self, and so on. He is not making an abstract philosophical statement as he would had he said, because all things are Buddha Dharma, therefore, the deliberate term, deliberate use of the term when or on the occasion seems to refer to the way things appear to certain individuals in various stages of understanding. Thus, in the first line, he may be saying that an individual may see the world of beings as a real world that needs to be seriously encountered, even though it is essentially empty. In such a case, even though all things are empty and without self, such things as delusion and death must not be seen as illusory or negligible, but as realities that are significant in terms of commitment. In the first line, he may be saying that an individual may see the world of beings as a real world that needs to be seriously encountered, even though it is essentially empty. Even though all things are empty and without self, such things as death and confusion must not be seen as illusory or negligible, but as realities that are significant in terms of commitment. In the second line, an individual may, on the contrary, see things as only empty, perhaps as illusory or insignificant. Therefore, there are no Buddhas, no delusion, no death, no life, and so forth. This would be a false emptiness and an immature, inauthentic grasp of what emptiness truly is, for it is not clear that emptiness is empty form. The third line does not take the qualifying term when. Rather, it takes a metaphysical stand. Because this is the way the Dharma is, and states the truth apart from personal experience. In doing so, it reaffirms the view set forth in the first line as being the truth that transcends being and emptiness, fullness, and deficiency. It is not that things are not empty or without self, as the second line says. It is a bedrock Mahayana teaching that all things are empty and without self. The problem is that the immature individual may become frozen within a simplistic, nihilistic perspective while viewing things as empty. The result is twofold. On the one hand, one may not take events seriously and may consequently fail to respond to them in an authentically enlightened manner. This is, in fact, a betrayal of the Mahayana approach to liberation in the world, for it fails to realize that although things are absolutely empty, things are nevertheless empty things and need to be taken seriously. Although all things are absolutely empty, things are nevertheless empty things and need to be taken seriously. This is particularly true with regard to the Bodhisattva vow to liberate all sentient beings. The true religious life of liberating others cannot become a reality for one who fails to realize the paradoxical truth that beings need to be liberated, although beings and liberation are both empty. The true religious life of liberating others cannot become a reality for one who fails to realize the paradoxical truth that beings need to be liberated, although beings and liberation both are empty. On the other hand, which is to say the same thing, To become frozen in a nihilistic experience of emptiness means that one fails to recognize that there is no emptiness apart from empty beings. No Buddha, no beings, no beings and no Buddha. Because emptiness is simply the way that beings are beings. On the other hand, to become frozen in a nihilistic experience of emptiness means that one fails to recognize that there is no emptiness apart from empty beings, because emptiness is simply the way that beings are beings. One must go further and understand that true emptiness is not a whit different from beings, and that true beings are exactly identical with emptiness. Again, this is Genjo Koan, which is vastly different from a purely negative view. So Uchiyama Roshi tries to help us out here. So the first and third line are confusing, that they're very similar, but they're also different. So the first line says, when all things are Buddha Dharma, there is delusion and realization, birth and death, ordinary people and Buddhas. And the third line is, since the Buddha way by nature goes beyond abundance and deficiency, there is life and death, delusion and realization, ordinary people and Buddhas. And Uchiyama Roshi says, these first three sentences are written in a parallel form. And yet we should pay careful attention to the fact that the subject of the first and the second sentence is Buddha Dharma, and the subject of the third sentence is Buddha Way. What is the difference between Buddha Dharma and Buddha Way? Previously, I quoted from Bendawa to understand the words Buddha Dharma. We should know that Buddha Dharma should be studied by giving up the view of self and other. We should know that Buddha Dharma should be studied by giving up the view of self and other. As a definition of Buddha Way, I will quote the following from Dogen Zenji's Gakudo-yo Jinshu. Just to practice Buddha Dharma for the sake of Buddha Dharma is the way. Just to practice Buddha Dharma for the sake of Buddha Dharma is the way. My own rendering into modern Japanese is as follows. Working to actualize the reality of life for the sake of the reality of life is the Buddha way. The world of Buddha Dharma does not deal with a two-dimensional dichotomy between this and that, between being and non-being. In the case of the Buddha way, the Buddha Dharma works for the sake of the Buddha Dharma. This is not a flat and simple manner. It is really complicated when we try to think about it and explain it with language. In reality, it is like driving a car. When we drive a car, we are already in the car. This is a matter of course. This is a matter of course. In the same way, when we live out our lives, we carry out the reality of our life for the sake of the reality of life, precisely because we are living out the reality of life. This is the Buddha way for us. Working to actualize the reality of life for the sake of the reality of life is the Buddha way. So this is, you know, revisiting Dogen's essential practice question. He said, if all beings are by nature originally enlightened, why do we have to work so hard? Why do we have to study? Why do we have to sit zazen? Why, if I'm already Buddha, why can't I just show up and be Buddha? And when he got back from China, his friends asked him, so did you figure out the answer to that driving question that sent you to China? And he said, yes, I did. And they said, well, what is it then? He said, well, you see, the nose is vertical, but the eyes are horizontal. Basically, what he's saying is that there is practicing the Buddha way isn't to become enlightened. We just practice the Buddha way because we practice the Buddha way, because we're human beings living out our human lives, and this is how we do it. This is how we live out our human lives. That we are essentially Buddha, and yet expressing Buddha means taking action in the world. When Suzuki Roshi lectured on the Genja Koan in 1971, he had a lot of concerns for his community, which I think are, you know, really reflect the concerns we have now. He said, since we have Tassajara and the city Zendo, our practice is rather concentrated on either city practice or Tassajara practice. Tassajara is the monastic trading center in a remote location in Northern California, Central California. So, you know, it's challenging to go between a temple in downtown San Francisco, in Lower Haight, San Francisco, to this remote location out in the wilderness where, you know, you don't have heated cabins or hot water. And people practicing in one place or the other have very strong feelings about people practicing in the other place. And what their practice is like, and how they're first of all, they're much less serious students than I am, but also, man, they're really lucky. They got a much easier life. And it doesn't matter where you're practicing. The people practicing in the other place are both less serious and more fortunate than I am. So, since we have Tassajara and the city Zendo, our practice is rather concentrated on city practice or on Tassajara practice. But the most important thing is to know what is Zen practice, which is not only city practice, but also Tassajara practice and city Zendo practice. Wherever you are, we have a Zen way of practice. No matter where you are, you must have proper understanding of our practice. This is our fundamental practice. It is better now, I think, for us to follow our more original way of Zen practice, which is to go beyond monastic practice or city Zendo practice or practice in city life. Wherever you are, this is the fundamental way of practice for us, or else we will be too much involved in city practice or monastic practice, and we will lose the point of practice, I'm afraid. So he was really worried about these, you know, these two camps, the dichotomy between the monastic monks and the city monks, and the lay people who visited city center, but didn't, you know, live there. They didn't live as either real monks or city monks. And I think we're feeling this now at Seattle Soto Zen, right? You know, I got my first COVID shot last week, got my Fauci Ochi And, you know, as more and more of us are getting vaccinated, we're getting really anxious to find a Zendo space in Seattle and start meeting each other in person again and have, you know, a Zendo community where we can sit together and support each other. And of course, in this past year, we've been putting a lot of work into our virtual offerings that we have created here, a place, a Zendo, where we can meet together and sit together and support each other. So it's, you know, we want to reopen, and we've made so many good friends in this virtual Zendo. We want to preserve the energy and the vibrancy of this online programming, especially, you know, people who can't come to a physical location in Seattle. And so how can we balance these two things going forward? And as you know, it's not about prioritizing one thing over the other. And it's not about putting equal energy into both at the same time. This is just meaning our lives and meeting each other moment after moment, right? Which is, you know, why it's so complicated. Why it's so hard to be human. And, you know, this is what Dogen's talking about. We don't practice in order to become enlightened. We practice because this is my life. I'm living the life of a Zen monk and I practice. And I find joy and satisfaction in this life. And I find a path of wisdom and kindness in this life. I truly believe that in doing this, I am enacting my vow to help other people. And it's only when, you know, it's like the drunk looking for their keychains under the streetlight, right? Years ago, I was trying to learn how to play the taiko drum for this complicated ceremony for Buddha's birthday, actually, which was 2 days ago. And there was a fellow monk at Tassajara was a musician. He played the drum in a jazz band. And so I asked him, you know, can you help me play this taiko drum for the ceremony coming up? And he said, okay, sure, show me what you've got. So I did my best on the taiko drum. And he said, well, it's about 3 weeks between now and the ceremony. And I could teach you a lot of technical skills for drumming, but you would not be able to learn anything helpful in the time we have, right? Definitely, I could teach you the technical skills to make you a better drummer, but we should have started 5 years ago. He said, so in this situation, my advice is, when you're playing the drum, try to love the drum. And what the drum does, it just amplifies and gives back whatever you put into it. You know, that's what a drum is. So even without technical skill, if you put love and joy into your playing, then some of that love and joy will the drum will respond and give back some of that love and joy. And maybe even the other people at the ceremony will be able to hear some of it. So, you know, I could say that this taiko drum is it's a skin that's stretched over a wooden frame, right? And this is true. I mean, that's what a taiko drum is. Things have a real world existence outside of my ideas of them. You know, a drum is different from a refrigerator. There is a reality out there that is not the same as my perception of reality. And I can't cause things to obey my perception just by thinking about it, right? A drum's going to go on stubbornly being a drum no matter what I think about it. And also the voice of the drum is born from the emptiness inside of it, right? It's this empty receptive space inside the drum that allows it to speak, that allows it to respond to whatever I put into it. You know, and this fundamental emptiness is what is necessary really for any response in any relationship. If all dharmas and all beings weren't intrinsically empty and without self, then we could never really meet each other. We could never really respond to the love that we receive from each other. And then also, it really doesn't matter either of these realities or any of the multiple realities about what is a drum, because if it just sits there on its own, it's not going to do anything. It doesn't matter how good or bad a drum is. If it just sits there, you're not going to hear it. So I actually have to do something, even if I don't know what I'm doing, right? I actually have to do something with this mess I've made of my life. I have to get out there and actually live it. Because otherwise nothing will happen. You know, in the Bodhisattva precept ceremony, we say, to express the Dharma with this body is foremost. That always really strikes me because I have a lot of problems in this body. And a lot of the time I think, well, I should probably wait until I'm a better person. And then I'll be able to express the Dharma properly. You know, I should really have started learning the drum 5 years ago, and then I would be able to play it 3 weeks from now. But that's not the way it is, right? If living beings need to be saved and I'm here, then I should save them. And maybe, definitely, other people could have saved them better, but they weren't there. You know, it would be like showing up at the Buddha's birthday celebration and it's like, well, I'm not a good drummer, so there just isn't going to be a drum. We just have to do it, live out the life that we have as kindly and as wholeheartedly as we can. And to trust that if I put love into it, that somehow this love will be communicated and will make a difference. Another one of Suzuki Roshi's famous quotes is that strictly speaking, there are no enlightened people. There is only enlightened activity. So Buddha isn't some enlightened, some you know, statue on the altar just sitting there being a Buddha, living in an enlightened state. A Buddha is whatever is doing Buddha activity in the world for as long as it's doing Buddha activity in the world. And when it stops doing Buddha things, it stops being Buddha. Because Buddhahood is in the actions that we take. So as long as I am enacting Buddha, I am Buddha. Completely. That's why Dogen Zenji says, you know, one moment of practice is one moment of Buddha. One moment of sitting zazen is one moment of enlightenment. Because sitting zazen is just the enlightened activity of Buddha. Strictly speaking, there are no enlightened people, only enlightened activity. So we have one more line for today. So we ended with, since the Buddha way by nature goes beyond abundance and deficiency, so there are birth and death, delusion and enlightenment, and sentient beings and Buddhas. And though it is like this, flowers die even though we love them, and weeds flourish even though we hate them. It's kind of a punch to the gut, isn't it? Flowers die though we love them, and weeds flourish though we hate them. That's just an expression of our human life. Suzuki Roshi says, here we have many things to think about. First of all, we should know how, we should know that this world, for human beings, not for birds or cats, but for human beings, this world is a world of suffering. Originally, for human beings, as long as we are human nature, as long as we are expressing our human nature, which is very selfish, we care for something which we cannot acquire and we cannot reach. Or maybe it's only because you cannot reach it that you want it. Because we do not stay young forever, we want to be young. Something which we cannot expect is something that we want. That is our human nature. So human life is at the same time a life of suffering. That is very true. We should know many things about our human nature. When you know about human nature deep enough, then you will start to practice Buddhism. It's like an operation. When the pain is strong enough to accept an operation, you will finally go to the doctor. But it is almost impossible to have this operation without pain. Because you have a great pain, because you know human nature well enough, you start to practice Buddhism, like you go to the doctor to have your operation. This is the nature of Buddhism. And that is why you practice zazen. When I do full prostrations, you know, I never used to need to put a hand down to get up from a full prostration. A few times, including my first visit to Seattle, people commented on it. And they said, oh, I can't do bows like you can. And I was like, well, yeah, no, that's because my 10 years of monastic training. And then I moved to Seattle. And then after about 3 months or maybe even less, I got hit by a car. And I was lucky. I was only very mildly injured, but my left hip, most of the time it's fine, but when I'm doing full prostrations, my left hip is like, yeah, actually I'm not the same hip I was when I was doing prostrations before. So actually when you stand up, I'm not going to cooperate. And that, it hurts my feelings a lot more than it probably should, because I didn't expect that I was so vain. And, you know, it's like, if, you know, if this had been, if I'd been 20 years younger, it would have gotten better by now. But it seems to be kind of just the way this hip is now. And it really bothers me, because, you know, if I just done one thing differently that day, then I wouldn't have been in that intersection I was in when the car hit me. And, you know, and more than that, it wasn't even my fault. I had the right of way and the car hit me. And that's basically what Dogen is saying in this first paragraph, is that, you know, to express the Dharma, fully inhabit the life I have and not the life that I should have or that I would have had if I'd done something different back when I could have done something different. You know, I make choices all the time without, you know, much knowledge of what the outcome will be most of the time. You know, I have to make these choices because this is how I live my life, right? I go to the store because I'm out of milk. On my way to the store, I get hit by a car. You know, how does this make sense in terms of what I did wrong or what I should have done differently? This is just the human life. It's a human life where I love flowers, but they still die. I hate weeds, but they keep growing. When Reverend Isan Dorsey was dying of AIDS, he said to his students, "Well, you know, everybody gets what they deserve, whether they deserve it or not. Everybody gets what they deserve, whether they deserve it or not. If you plant flowers, your flowers are going to die. If you have a garden, weeds are going to grow in it." And even, you know, even more painful situation is, what if I do deserve it? What if I really act in a way that is cruel or selfish or just, you know, negligent? And I hurt myself and I hurt other people. Not only do I have to go on living in this world that I created through my selfish action, but I also have to keep on living as the kind of person who would do that thing. Because obviously I am. I can't go on saying I am not the kind of person who would do something so cruel to someone I love. Because I'm just that person, because I did that cruel thing. You know, my Buddhist chaplaincy training, our chaplaincy cohort went on a field trip to San Quentin Prison. And we met with a prison chaplain who worked with violent offenders there. And we sat in on a group counseling session. And the prison chaplain started off, he introduced the group by saying how this, I think there were 18 people in the group, 18 or 20, And he said he talked about how their first meeting, they added up all of their sentences, the men, the sentences they were serving for these violent crimes. And cumulatively, they were serving some astonishingly great number of, like 400 years, that they had, between all 20 of them, they'd been sentenced to 400 years in prison. And then the next math exercise was adding up the cumulative time they'd spent committing their violent offenses. And it was something like 38 minutes. So 38 minutes of crime for 400 years of sentencing. And it's not that, you know, this is, again, this is just the way life is. You know, I've not been feeling so great the past month or so. So I finally went to the doctor last week, and I've got a bleeding ulcer. So I went to the doctor on Wednesday. We're pretty sure I've got an ulcer. It's happened before, so it's like, yeah, it seems like this is what happened last time. And I got back from the doctor, started off our 3-day session, got up early yesterday morning and made a big pot of coffee. And then I spent the first two periods of morning zazen yesterday morning being violently sick, because I drank a big pot of coffee right after being diagnosed with a massive ulcer, right? I was like, I need my coffee. I deserve my coffee. How can you sit a 3-day session without a cup of coffee? And at the same time, when I spent those first two periods of zazen violently ill, I'm like, yeah, this is because I've got an ulcer and I drank a pot of coffee anyway. You know, I got what I deserved, even though I didn't deserve it at all. This is, you know, this is just human life. This is, I live my life. And even though I try my best, the flowers die, as much as I love them, as much joy as they bring me. I want them to live, but they die. And weeds will keep growing. As soon as my back is turned, the weeds will grow. At Tassajara, when I worked in the garden, we had have an ongoing war with the squirrels that they really want in the compost shed. And, you know, they keep getting into the compost shed. And I said, you know, it's not that I want the squirrels to win, but I have to admit, you know, they kind of deserve it, because they're really putting in the effort here. Because, you know, if you're a gardener at Tassajara Monastery, you have other things to do throughout the day besides guard the compost shed. But the squirrels have nothing else to do except chew their way into the compost shed. So this is it, right? You know, I keep living my life and I keep being a selfish, deluded human being and acting like one. And I still, right? But what other option do I have? You know, I know the squirrels are going to win, but I can't stop trying to patch up the compost shed. Because then, you know, we'll really have a squirrel problem. I know that flowers are going to die, but you know, if I just, you know, stop even taking care of them, then what am I proving? Okay, now they've died faster. So, great. I have shown the whole world that flowers will die. I won. And that's, you know, if I love something, then that love will bring me hurt. But still, you know, just to love wholeheartedly, to put that love into what I'm doing, because I only get out what I put in. I want to end with a poem. I think I've ended another Dharma talk with the same poem, but I like it, so I'm going to read it again. And I feel like it sort of sums up this first paragraph of Genjo Koan. You know, when all dharmas are Buddha Dharma, there is delusion and realization. There is practice, there is life, and there is death. There are Buddhas and there are ordinary beings. When the myriad dharmas are without self, there is no delusion and no realization, no Buddhas and no ordinary beings, no life and no death. The Buddha's truth is originally transcendent over abundance and scarcity. And so there is life and death. There is delusion and realization. There are beings and Buddhas. And yet, flowers die even though we love them. And weeds flourish though we hate them. So this is A Ritual to Read to Each Other by William E. Stafford. If you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, a pattern that others made may prevail in the world, and following the wrong God home, we may miss our star. For there is many a small betrayal in the mind, a shrug that lets the fragile sequence break, sending with shouts the horrible errors of childhood, storming out to play through the broken dike. And as elephants parade, holding each elephant's tail, but if one wanders, the circus won't find the park. I call it cruel, and maybe the root of all cruelty, to know what occurs, but not recognize the fact. And so I appeal to a voice, to something shadowy, a remote, important region in all who talk. Though we could fool each other, we should consider, lest the parade of our mutual life get lost in the dark. For it is important that awake people be awake, or a breaking line may discourage them back to sleep. The signals we give, yes or no, or maybe, should be clear. The darkness around us is deep. If you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, the pattern that others made may prevail in the world, and following the wrong God home, we may miss our star. For there is many a small betrayal in the mind, a shrug that lets the fragile sequence break, sending with shouts the horrible errors of childhood, storming out to play through the broken dike. And as elephants parade, holding each elephant's tail, but if one wanders, the circus won't find the park. I call it cruel, and maybe the root of all cruelty, to know what occurs, but not recognize the fact. And so I appeal to a voice, to something shadowy, a remote, important region in all who talk. Though we could fool each other, we should consider, lest the parade of our mutual life get lost in the dark. For it is important that awake people be awake, or a breaking line may discourage them back to sleep. The signals we give, yes or no, or maybe, should be clear. The darkness around us is deep.
And I needed a push to get me to see. Wherever I am, I'm already free.
Thank you for listening. Please find us at seattlesotozen.org. Our theme music is by Stuart Davis. Gosh, show! Oh.